Should Muslims have alliances or not? And I've always been against any alliances. When people talk about the Muslims aligned with the left, Muslims aligned with the right, I tend to think it's mostly an imagination because you don't have what are you offering? Neither do we have a massive voting bloc, let's say here in America. England, yeah, right? Neither do we have a lot of money. So is this alliance in your head? Is it just like something you talk about? And the reach is one way. The discussion is one way. No one on that side is catering and trying to have an alliance with our community. So when we talk about this, I really respect an article written by Sheikh Mateen Khan. Sheikh Mateen Khan is one of our neighbors in the area, and he teaches Hanafi fiqh, and him and I do programs. So he says, Islam and Muslims have a long history in America and are very much part of the legacy of the United States. Muslims and non-Muslims have worked together, lived together, played together. We have constructed institutions of peace and have even fought wars together. I would say Muslims have been involved in these things more so than we've done it all together, like as if we're a significant social and political body, which I don't think that we are in the United States, at least. In England, yeah, maybe. This involves collaboration with groups whose values and teachings may be in direct opposition to Islamic ethics, morality, code, Sharia, etc. So this article attempts to guide Muslim leaders at all levels and the general Muslim public at large in a direction which benefits the national interest and protects Islam. All right, let's take a look at the fiqh. So the first thing, there are conditions in Islam, but ultimately the subject matter is ijtihadi. When do I make a deal with another group of people? If the deal entails something forbidden in Islam, then we don't need a discussion. We know that that's unlawful, right? But if it doesn't, but I'm getting cozy with a group that does other bad things or un-Islamic things, that's an ijtihadi matter. You're really just weighing right and wrong. And you may have, ultimately, at the worst case scenario, is you believe that person is upon a misguided error, not sinful, right? You think this is an error of judgment, and it could lead to harms in the future. Speculation. That's all speculation, right? So he says here that we cannot be swept up in the euphoria of nationalism or anti-establishment rhetoric by simply following the masses, or the words of a dynamic speaker. After the Prophet's migration, jurisprudence and state legislation were unified under his guidance and the guidance of several khulafa. However, since this time, the two have been separated. Islamic scholarship has been engaged in a process of risk management and the defense of Islam. Our main priority as Muslims is to be able to live, worship, and live our lives in a way pleasing to Allah. And every Muslim by necessity believes that Allah Ta'ala has guided us solely for our benefit. Right, so the role of Islamic scholarship and leadership has been and continues to be charting a course that defends normative Islam through constant harm-benefit analysis. And it's been a long time that the leaders of nations and Islamic scholarships who care about the Quran have been separate. Right? Somebody once asked me recently, why is it that all the masajid operate by calculation? But yet all the madaris, all the Dar Ulums, all the Islamic seminaries, they all uphold moonsighting. Like, by the book, the argument, moonsighting is the default, and these other ideas are fatawa, right? And many, many, many scholars deem these fatawa to be false fatawa, incorrect fatawa. It's a fatwa, but it could be right and wrong, and they deem it to be wrong. Well, the answer is that masajid aren't even run by, even the masajid are not run by scholars. It's crazy. Like, their executive power of the scholarly class in the ummah has shrunk so much that they do not even run the masajid anymore. They may run their zawiya or their Dar Ulum institutions or their madaris. They don't even run the masajid. Right? And even in Islamic countries, when they do, it's with orders. So, whenever masajid are now predominantly run by administrators, they run masajid. Not scholars may have more or less input in masajid. And Sheikh Amin runs his from top to bottom. I mean, Muhammad in Atlantic City. Alhamdulillah, MBIC gives me a lot of space, but ultimately the vast majority of masajid are just run by admins. An admin, you can't expect him to know the difference between a fatwa and a ruling, and what is the dominant opinion of the scholars about on a fatwa. They're not going to know that. They can't be expected to know that. It's like if I ran a hospital, right? If I ran a hospital, I've never been through and through with doctors in the field of medicine in a way that would satisfy another doctor. So I'm going to make decisions that just make sense to me personally. And that will send a lot of doctors. It's going to be pragmatics. Doctors will be going crazy. So whenever collaboration with another group is suggested, you have to judge the harm and the benefit. All right. If there is some formal agreement, that formal agreement cannot possess anything forbidden in it. I would go even further than that, and I would say that it's extremely, you got to be extremely cautious even about, I'd be extremely cautious even about sentiment with these groups. Showing favorable sentiment to the right or the left or some other group, if you're a scholar, if you're a leader, your one favorable sentiment is going to sway a lot of people, right? And then they start to soften towards those ideas. And I think most people, generally people in general, tend to be sort of like one group. Like they'll take the whole thing or leave the whole thing. Very few people can etch out, yeah, I agree with this, but not this. I like what he says here, but I'm not like, most people don't do this. They either accept him or reject. So that you got to keep in mind that mentality of the people you're talking to as well. So he says, for this, we turn to the legal maxim, دَرْءُ الْمَفَاسِدِ أَوْلَى مِنْ جَلْبِ الْمَصَالِحِ. The prevention of harm precedes the attainment of benefits. This particular maxim is extrapolated, among other things, from the prophetic hadith, if I forbid you to do something, then keep away from it. If I order you to do something, do as much of it as you can. It is based on this maxim, for example, that Muslims are not permitted to make beneficial changes to their property that might cause harm to their neighbor. Some benefits me but harms my neighbor. For example, another example of those, I can't lower my prices so much in order to benefit the community in a manner that would put my neighbor out of business. And in, for example, in the old days, you used to have all the juicers in one area, all the butchers, that makes life easy for everybody. They could compare all the meat or compare all the clothes in one area. So it's actually, we're taught in fiqh that you're not allowed to lower your prices even to benefit society, the people, if that would cause your neighbor to go out of business. Even if you just want to be charitable. So that's a halal thing that you're doing that looks good on the outside, but it harms somebody else. And even if it benefits 100 people in their single transaction of buying the meat, but it destroys another person's full livelihood. And livelihood is over a transaction, right? Livelihood is more important. So we don't judge in Islam a thing just by the intent, nor by the immediate image of what it is. It's also judged by the clear result that it's having. Now, if the result is speculative and we don't know, then that's different. But it's always good to review this and to look at these masail of ilm.